This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Do violent extremists have common characteristics and backgrounds? Can we predict who among them will become violent? We're joined by Patrick James. He's a researcher at START at the University of Maryland, and he's the project manager for the Profiles of Individual Radicalization in the United States project. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Patrick James. It's great to have you here with us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
You have been studying radicalization. I thought the best place to start is in the U.S., the numbers that we see. How many people are we talking about, and how big are these radical groups?
It's really hard to say how many people exactly in the United States have radicalized. We draw a sample of U.S.-based extremists, and we have the largest database that we know of, and that stands at about 1,500. But we know that's just a small fraction of the amount of people who are active in extremist groups in the United States. I know there are at least tens of thousands of people who are sympathetic to these types of views.
One of the things I read about your study is that something like 43% are in the far right ideological category. Is that right?
That's right. That's what we have in our data. And when we say far right, that's a very broad term for a lot of overlapping movements. So that typically is going to include groups like white supremacists, KKK, neo-Nazis, the type of groups that we've seen active recently in places like Charlottesville, but that also includes groups that hold specifically anti-government type ideologies, sovereign citizens, radical militias, anti-immigrant groups. So it's a very broad category that has a lot of overlapping movements, but that is right. About 43% of our data are classified as the far right, and that's the largest category that we have in the data.
You mentioned militia movements, the anti-government, the sovereign citizens, the white nationalists. I guess that would be include the KKK.
That's right.
Who else are you talking about when you say right-wing groups?
Specifically, we're talking about the KKK. They have dozens of chapters around the country. Historically, going back throughout the U.S., the modern sort of far-right movement really has its roots in the 1980s. Groups like The Order specifically targeted well-known Jewish Americans, and they had a few kidnapping plots. And then you really see this large growth of far-right groups, militias. A lot of them are sort of local chapters that aren't bigger than people. And now you really see this sort of coming together of a lot of these groups. They're meeting with each other online, be able to connect with one another, and able to come up and really have a show of force in places like Charlottesville. So it's really varied sort of movement with dozens and dozens of different types of groups.
So would you say, given what you just described to us, that the internet has really been a facilitation tool?
Absolutely. Facilitation, communication tool, and mobilization tool. The internet works to connect these groups instantly. In the past, to have any sort of functional extremist group, you had to know them face-to-face, be able to have a secure meeting, physical meeting place. Now in the past decade or so, especially now with social media, these individuals are able to find each other so much easier and form these online communities that sort of act as echo chambers, as meeting places and places to swap ideas and in some cases to mobilize in physical space.
When you look across all of the people that are in your database, I saw a quote from one of your colleagues, from Gary LaFrie, who I think heads the program over there. He said in the New York Times that the far right groups are really the most likely to commit violence, like what we saw in Charlottesville. Is there a trend that it's worsening?
It's hard to say if there's a trend. The data that we're going off of right now only goes through 2013, and we're working on updating the data set. And we haven't done any sort of trend analysis on the rates of violence. But what I can say is that he's right in that those on the far right are more likely to engage in violence than those who are motivated by extreme left-wing ideologies. But they're also sort of at the same level in terms of violence with extremists motivated by Islamist ideologies, like those inspired by Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Really, what we see in the data is that the far right and Islamists neck and neck when it comes to likelihood to commit violence, whereas the far left is far more likely to engage in activities that directly harm property, or they engage in vandalism or some sort of industrial sabotage, but they tend to not, in the past couple of decades at least, engage in direct violence themselves.
And then you've also been studying patterns or trying to understand how radicalization actually happens. So let's look at some of those factors. It sounded like, from what I read, it's so varied, it's hard to discern specific factors that are driving the radicalization, but there seem to be tendencies. So can we talk about some of those? One seemed to be ideology among the right wing.
Absolutely. You are right. It's hard to say. If anything that radicalization researchers agree upon, it's that radicalization is complex and that it's a complex process that doesn't unfold in a straight line. It's not linear. But what we can say is that we see across ideologies, so this goes for far right, far left, Islamists, and even those motivated by a single issue, so think like anti-abortion extremists, we see a pattern that those who radicalize in these what we call cliques, so these small insular groups of people, typically 3 to 12 members, when they isolate themselves from the rest of society, and you see these group dynamics kick in, like groupthink and group polarization, those types of people tend to engage in violence more often. We also see that those with some sort of criminal history, and again, this holds across ideologies, those with some sort of criminal history are more likely to engage in violence than those who don't have a criminal history. So we do see these commonalities sometimes across ideologies. In addition to those two factors, we see generally low levels of abuse, being victims of abuse, as well as drug abuse, or those sorts of risk factors that are commonly thought of to lead to radicalization. We don't see a lot of evidence for that. And we also see relatively low levels of mental illness. So I know that's often talked about when we discuss radicalization. Sometimes the bridge between mental illness and radicalization to violent extremism is sometimes blurred, and it's a complicated relationship. But the idea that extremists are crazy, that they're all mentally unstable, is something that does not hold out in the data.
Of course, it's hard to know that unless they have a diagnosis. And I can't imagine that it would be easy to know whether or not there has been a diagnosis in these cases. So it's hard to say on that.
Yeah, one of the challenges we have with the data is that we are reliant on open source material. So sometimes it is difficult to come across concrete diagnoses of mental illness. You're absolutely right.
So the other things I found interesting were demographics, commonalities, like people had traditionally thought that people who fall into these extremist groups tend to be poor, but that turns out to not be the case at all.
That's right. When we look at the socioeconomic background of extremists across the entire sample, the biggest group come from middle-class backgrounds. There is some slight variation. So those on the far right are less likely to achieve higher levels of education. For instance, only 25% of far-right extremists attained a college degree compared to 43% for the rest of the sample. And they're also less likely to come from a high level of socioeconomic background. That being said, middle-class background is still the most common thing. In terms of demographics, we find that there is some differences across the far right and the far left in Islamists. Far right extremists tend to be older, so an average age of 36 by the time they kind of come to public awareness, usually by their arrest, compared to 31 years of age for the entire sample. And they're also more likely to be male. 95% of the far right in our sample are male, compared to about 89 to 90% for the rest of the sample. We see the majority for every category of sort of ideological milieu is overwhelmingly male. The highest percentage of females we see is in the far left. About a quarter of the far left are females.
In terms of the radicalization mechanisms, you noted personal psychology and collective psychology. Just a little while ago when we were talking, you said, of course, there's things like groupthink and conformity. How does that all work out?
It's a complex process. The philosopher Immanuel Kant once said that from the crooked timbers of humanity, never a straight thing was made. And that really holds up when we think about radicalization and how it works at the individual level. So it's possible for us to draw these broad comparisons across ideologies. Looking at it and digging into it, the individual level, the process itself is difficult. But with some of the research we've done, using some methodologies that can handle this sort of idea of complexity, we can begin thinking of radicalization in terms of multiple pathways. And we found a number of conditions that really set the stage for active violent extremism. The first condition is what we call cognitive frame alignment. And that means a person undergoes some sort of fundamental shifts in the way they come to view the world. And perhaps more importantly, how they actually handle new information that they encounter, which runs against their belief system. So it kind of provides an environment for a radicalization to take place, this sort of mental shift that disallows the person to think critically of incoming information. The second and probably more important condition, and I think more interesting one, is that we find when a person develops what we call a sense of a community crisis, it seems to be hugely important for whether or not they engage in violence. A community crisis is when they come to closely align or identify with a group that they consider to be under some sort of existential threat by a hostile external group. And we see this across ideologies. So for the far right, that's often manifested in terms of the federal government, which a lot of them see as run by some sort of conspiratorial Jewish shadow government. Or we also see it, for instance, in a lot of Islamist and Al-Qaeda type narratives where they see Muslims around the world being under threat from a hostile Western power. When people identify with the group that they see to be under threat, that seems to be one of the most important things that actually leads to violent vocalization.
Well, that would make sense. And given the media messages that some of their websites and even some of the more mainstream right wing put forward, it really starts to make logical sense that if they really believe that, they would be afraid and concerned and believe there's really an existential threat.
Absolutely. And a lot of these sites do a really good job at sort of packaging a narrative and selling it. They typically don't start out, you know, giving them the entire sort of narrative all at once. Usually it's a slow process that, you know, it's an incremental step process. But once you become fully committed to the ideology, it's a really compelling argument that, you know, for instance, for white supremacists, that the white race is being under a constant state of threat from a hostile federal government and hostile minorities who are trying to take some sort of position of privilege away from them. It becomes a really powerful motivating factor for a lot of these people.
And I imagine with the current president in the U.S. administration legitimizing these beliefs, it seems to make even more sense.
Absolutely. We've seen, I think, an uptick in hate crime incidents since November of last year. I know the Southern Poverty Law Center, they do a great job at tracking instances of hate crimes over time. And I believe they've seen a huge uptick since the current administration has taken over. But when you see that sort of rhetoric and that sort of messaging coming from the very top, it certainly doesn't help the situation any.
Finally, one of the things I thought were really interesting is that families don't really matter that much.
Yeah, we found that family members tend not to have a huge influence on whether or not someone's likely to be violent. We find that peers seem to really be the deciding factor of whether or not someone is going to behave violently or non-violently. However, families, I do think they play a big role when we think about intervention and prevention programs. People who are closest to an individual that's going on some sort of extremist path are going to be the ones who see them every day. And that's going to be their family members, sometimes their close friends. So there has to be some sort of space right now for family members who, concerned mothers and fathers and siblings and other people close to the person. There has to be some sort of space for them to go to, be able to help the person, be able to get the resources they need to get the person onto some sort of off-ramp. And we see from all sorts of research looking at de-radicalization that the influence of the close family is very important to bringing people out of extremist groups.
So it doesn't bring them in as much as it does help to get them out.
I think that's where the research is pointing at this point, yeah.
Well, Patrick James, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us on the Scholar Circle.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Patrick James, researcher at START at the University of Maryland, and he's the project manager for the Profiles of Individual Radicalization in the United States project.